Good morning. Welcome to Zen Center. So, this morning, I'll start by telling you what the three treasures are. A lot of you know this, and some of you don't. The three treasures, the three jewels in Buddhism are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And roughly translated, that's the teacher, the teaching, and the community. The teacher, the teaching, and the community. And because this is a Zen center, we have a way of playing with terms, exploding them a little bit. So for us, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are not limited to literal teachers, teaching, and community. They're much more spacious than that. They're very big. They're very big. So for us in Zen, Dharma, which traditionally means the teachings of the historical Buddha, would mean the teachings of the historical Buddha, subsequent ancestors, koan collections, commentary on koan collections, commentary on koan collections, your opinion, perhaps, of commentary on commentary. I think it would be a mistake for us to limit Dharma to Buddhism. I think it would be a mistake to limit it to language. It would be a mistake to limit it to sound. It would be a mistake to limit Dharma at all, right? Dharma. Tell me, what isn't teaching you? As we were doing our Zazen this morning, I heard the bells from the Greek Orthodox Church up there and went, oh, that's wonderful Dharma. That's the best Dharma these folks are going to get today. And then I was looking at the beautiful wood floor we have here. Went, oh, all those boards are teaching me about their lives. All the rain and the soil and the cold and the heat. All of their experience of being oak trees. The Dharma is right there. So, we say in our vows, we say in our Bodhisattva vows, which we'll chant together at the end of the talk here. They're on the bottom of your program. We say in our Bodhisattva vows, Dharma gates are boundless. The gates of the teaching, the possibilities of learning are limitless. The Dharma gates are boundless. They are unlimited. They are not bound. So, not bound to Buddhism, not bound to words. They are not bound to ideas. They are not bound to human understanding. The Dharma gates are unbounded everywhere, right? And so that brings me to what I've decided to talk about today. I have had the song, the poem, Row, Row, Row Your Boat, in my head now for a couple of months. It's a pretty good song, actually. So if you're going to have that sort of perseverating melody line in your head, I would choose this as one of my top 10 probably. And so because I've had plenty of time to review the words in my head, I have come to the conclusion that it's good Dharma, and I have come to the conclusion that there are six teachings in this short poem. I strongly encourage you to find more. I strongly encourage you to find 12 teachings or 1,000 teachings. And Tim, as I was telling just a few minutes ago, Tim actually gave a talk on Row, Row, Row Your Boat. I don't know how many years ago, 5 years ago or something. It was on one of those Sangha meeting Sundays where the Dharma talk is only like 15 minutes, very short. And he did about 15 minutes on Row, Row, Row Your Boat. So I'm stealing, but I'm stealing from the best. So yeah. It's all good. Check in the website archives. The MZMC website archives if you want to hear Tim's talk. So here's what I found. We've got a four-line poem. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Those are our four lines. That's our Dharma this morning. And our first line starts with row, row, row. So, effort. Sorry. Effort. Effort. We call this Zen practice. It is practice. It's activity. It's doing. Discipline. Work. We say it three times in a row. Row, row, row. Row, 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 right? Sit, sit, sit. Session, session, session. There's no getting around it. Zen puts a lot of emphasis on effort. The starting point is effort. The spirit of repetition is really alive in Zen. Do it again. Do it again. Do it again. Consistency. Repetition. That's your sitting. Do your sitting every day. Every day. Every day. It's funny we say repetition because that sort of creates the idea in our head that we're doing the same thing multiple times, and of course we're not. That's impossible. You can never have the same sitting twice, obviously. No matter how many times you've driven to Zen Center or along the exact same route, you've never taken the exact same route twice. It's not possible. But the spirit of repetition invites us by revisiting the same spaces, the same activity, the same physical posture. It invites us to see the dynamism, right, in our experience. This was a different route to Zen Center today. This sitting really was a different sitting, right? The nature of my experience is constant change. And when I experience constant change within a container of sameness, perceived repetition, it allows me to help see that change, right? That dynamism. So the activity of practice, row, row, row. For us in Zen, Zen is what we do in the beginning. Practice is what we do in the beginning. Practice is what we do in the middle. Practice is what we do at the end. Dogen, who's the founder of Soto Zen, our school of Zen in Japan, talks about the practice of Zen being a circle. The path is a circle. It's a circle. And the good news about that is that you never have to worry about arriving because you're already there. And every step is the first step. Every step is the arriving step. We're always going. Row, row, row. We then come to your boat. So that's good news. Or maybe not. It depends on the nature of how you see your boat, I guess. Row, row, row the person sitting next to you's boat. Your kid's boat, your parents' boat, your spouse's boat, all the people in your life who you have opinions on how they should be rowing. We're very good at this. We are very good at this, taking responsibility for others. Some of us have been very carefully trained to do that, haven't we? For good or for ill. Self-responsibility is huge in Buddhism in general. It's especially huge in Zen. Self-responsibility. It's bigger than it sounds. When I say self-responsibility, that's correct. It points in the right direction, and that is 100% true. But it's also it also sounds like it's limited somehow to you, and it's not limited to you. Self-responsibility is responsibility. Big R, just it includes everything. But our practice is about getting me to the cushion, setting my timer, doing the practice, signing up for the session, doing the practice. It's my commitment to it. I'm the only one who knows if I kept my commitment. I'm the only one who knows what's happening to my heart-mind as I give myself to this. Self-responsibility. In Buddhism, because we're all here basically to address the problem of human suffering, that's essentially the point of Buddhism, address, transform human suffering, and because suffering is seen to arise in the mind, there is only one place I ultimately can address my own experience, take responsibility for my own experience, keep my practice in my heart. It's really just me. Unlike everybody, of course, I'm very moved to want to adjust you so that I feel better. That's what we spend a lot of time doing, of course. Please behave in such a way that I'm not feeling anxious. Thank you. That was entirely about me. I really want to control you so I feel better. But when we start looking at the mind on the cushion, we start doing this very simple thing called Zen, we start realizing, oh, self-responsibility is really the core of all of it. So hopefully after we've been practicing for a while, the your boat part starts making great intuitive sense. And then when something in my life is kind of cranking me off, I hopefully don't start by trying to control that circumstance or that person. I can hopefully start by going, oh, what's going on in me right now? I see suffering arising. I notice suffering arising. How can I care for it? It's my responsibility. Right? How do I care for this suffering? I see it's arising. Okay. And the boat metaphor here that our poet, songwriter, whatever is using is really good for this because you literally cannot row anyone else's boat. I mean, you could try to lean over. I'm not even sure how it would work. It would probably end up with you swimming, I'm guessing. You literally can only row the boat you're in. It's only yours. We can help others. We can teach others. We offer support to others. We offer guidance to others. We offer them connection. We offer them love. But we can't row their boats. And our hearts break sometimes when we know that. And sometimes actually we experience that as freedom. But it's true. It's true. It's true. The rowing is theirs, not ours. Our rowing is ours. So, row, row, row your boat. Practice, practice, practice. It's your practice. So our second line starts with the word gently. Isn't that nice? Gently. Our whole first line is about effort, effort, and keep your eyes on your own paper, right? And now it's like, but gently. Gently. Please gently. Katagiri Roshi said, our goal is to have kind consideration for all sentient beings, every moment, forever. So my all-time favorite Zen lines ever. Our goal is to have kind consideration for all sentient beings, every moment, forever. That's gentle. That's really gentle. There's a strength to that type of gentleness, don't you think? This isn't just laying down. This isn't being a doormat type of gentle. There's a deep courage, right, to that type of gentle. Tremendous strength to that kind of gentle. But our effort, because it's sustained effort, it's disciplined effort, it's repeated effort, it's easy for us, if we're not careful, to turn this into something striving, something constricted, something macho, something maybe even self-flagellatory. Do you know how that kind of can be? Like, is this thing I got to do in order to be good? Or you know, it can turn into something constrictive so easily for us. So it's so important to be reminded gently. Gently. We say grandmotherly in Zen. Grandmotherly mind. Please have a grandmotherly mind toward your practice. Right? Parents tend to get a little, nah. More. Less. Go in your room. Think about what you did. I mean, other people's parents, I'm sure, do this too, right? Thank you. Okay. I thought I was alone there for a minute. But grandmotherly, grandparents are more like, oh, sweetie, it's so good to see you. There's cookies in the drawer to the right of the stove. And I won't tell your mom if you... I hope that wasn't just my grandma. I hope you all got cookies. This is in keeping the gentle... term is in keeping with the spirit of ahimsa, the Sanskrit word ahimsa. It means non-harm. Practice is non-harming. When your posture is uncomfortable, it's not a problem. When it begins to harm you with its pain, you move. The spirit of non-harm is what informs the precepts. The spirit of non-harm is what informs right speech, right action, right livelihood. Non-harm. Right? Non-harming. So we start with this idea of gently, and we turn it into non-grasping, we turn it into non-conflictive, we turn it into non-adversarial. The reason is because our grasping, our attachment, our aversion, our conflict cause suffering. They're just basically not what we're here to do. If we're here to transform suffering, we are not here to create suffering. Duh. So when we find ourselves going down that path, go, oh, I recognize this way of thinking, this way of acting, this way of talking is going to cause conflict or is causing conflict or suffering or constriction or sadness. And I want to refrain from doing that. I want my practice to be gentle. And I know that in Zen we have a lot of literature that talks about the practice itself being something that is done with fervor and with intensity. And a lot of us know the old saying, practice like your hair is on fire. Practice like your hair is on fire. I'm not sure how that shows up after we're ordained. I don't know. We'll have to... You and I. Oh, get rid of the fire. Practice like your hair is on fire. And we do. We honestly do. We do practice, but we practice like it's gently on fire. We have to. So gently is an interesting word here. We're here to transform the problem of human suffering. We are here to address the problem of life and death. It's a very big deal. It's a very serious deal. And we do practice with fervor, and we do practice with intensity. And we do practice like our hair is on fire. But it doesn't mean constricted. It doesn't mean grasping. It's gentle, steady, sustained. It's not a sprint, it's a marathon. Have you ever seen an elite runner run a marathon? It's almost effortless. You know they're going way faster than you probably could, even in your car. And yet, the quality of the motion is just like water. It's so gentle. It's so gentle. Like they can keep that up for 26 miles because it's very gentle. That's what we're looking for. And Soto Zen, our type of Zen, is especially famous for being very turtle-ish. We are not cheetahs in this room. We are turtles. Patient, slow. And I think this is because if we know the path is a circle, we just walk it. I'm not in a hurry to get to the end. There is no end. I'm walking to walk. My effort is sustained and it's gentle. And I'm aware of the importance, the white-hot importance of walking that, how important that is. And yet, it doesn't have to be hurried, right? It can be gentle. So, and when we're in a river and we're in a boat, the reason we get away with rowing gently is because the river is helping us, right? We are rowing down the stream. Gently down the stream. Isn't that nice? We're rowing down the stream. Not up the stream. Not against the current. Not against the nature of how things are. The nature of the river is to flow that way. It's going south. I recognize the nature of things as they are, and I am wise enough to go south. The Tao Te Ching, Taoism has a lot of influence on Zen thought, and if you ever read the Tao Te Ching or the Xuanzi, you'll see a lot of what feels very much like Zen thought, if you're into that kind of stuff. And the Tao Te Ching has a line I think about a lot when I'm on the freeway on one of the clover leaves. The line is, yielding is the way of the Tao. And so I think, oh, I'm about to yield. So maybe I'll turn this into practice instead of, how do I get ahead of the big SUV? How do I just yield? You know, that zipper thing we're supposed to do as good Minnesotans when we're, yeah. Yielding is the way of the Tao, the way of all things. Now, that isn't to say that we do not endeavor to change things that need changing. Sometimes the wind is blowing in a way that it should not be blowing, or that we find afflictive. But what it is to say is that we start with clear seeing. We cannot see clearly if we are bound by our agenda, by our opinion, by our biases, by our preferences. When I think reality is showing up broken, I have a problem. So recognizing the direction in which the river is flowing is an incredibly important starting point. So I'm thinking of the example of a ship, which is still a rowboat, but it's just a really big rowboat. I know they have oars down there when they need them. If you're on a sailboat in the middle of the Atlantic, you cannot fight the wind. But you can work with it. I have friends who sail, and you can, what they call tack, I guess. You're using the wind coming at you to go toward the wind. That's brilliant. I'm not sure how it works. I don't know. If you know about that, you can explain it. That's like physics or something. So again, this doesn't limit our movement. The direction of the river doesn't limit your movement. The direction of the wind doesn't limit your movement. But starting with knowing the way the things are going is crucially important. When we have that relationship with it, even if I'm tacking against the wind is helping me to do that. When I'm rowing down the stream, I can allow my rowing to be gentle because the river is helping me. I'm not working against the nature of reality. I'm working with it. I'm working with it. And we also know that when we're in the middle of the ocean in a boat, making even a 1% course correction in the middle of the Atlantic is going to have a massive impact on the place I arrive. Right? That little tiny adjustment. After we've gone 1,000 miles in that direction, that 1% is huge. And that's all Zen ever asks of you, is a 1% course correction. 1%. That seems doable. That seems doable. So, we're up to the third line. Merrily, 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 merrily. This is the most important word in the poem. So say I. Evidently. The poem says merrily 4 times. Right in a row. Like it really wants you to get this. Yeah. Merrily, 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 merrily. I don't often repeat myself 4 times. Well, actually, no, my wife. My wife's not here. I never repeat myself 4 times. Merrily, 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 merrily. So we say merrily more times than we say row. Right? We got 3 rows. That's how important practice is. Oh my God, there's just nothing but rowing in this Zen center. Row, row, row. Zazen, zazen, zazen. Sit, sit, sit. Retreat, retreat, retreat. Silence, silence, silence. Oh, but remember? Merrily, 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 merrily. That's why we're doing this. It is joy. It is joy. It is merrily, right? 4 times in a row. Thich Nhat Hanh, a name I know a lot of you know, says, if your practice does not bring you joy, you are not practicing correctly. That's a pretty simple statement. If your practice does not bring you joy, you are not practicing correctly. My little addendum there is we're using the word joy with some intention. Joy doesn't always mean showing up as pleasure. All of you who know the nature of joy, the nature of love, the nature of... It's like, oh, it sometimes shows up very inconveniently and very painfully. Ta-da! Welcome to your life. Joy is something much, much bigger than just the next shiny object, momentary happiness, momentary pleasure. We all do things in our lives we're deeply committed to doing that give us a huge amount of joy and oftentimes bring us a tremendous amount of circumstantial inconvenience. I don't know. Anybody who's ever done a Zen retreat totally knows what that is. Like, wow, what in the world was that? I can hardly wait to do that again. There was such joy there, but my back was killing me for a week straight. And the meals were always late, even when they were on time, because I was hungry. Yeah. And the person sitting next to me was breathing loud. This is not the way I want it to be. And yet, oh, well, yeah. It's just like love. It's like loving somebody even though they drive you nuts. That's all we're talking about. And in Zen, the joy of practice is to practice. Isn't that beautiful? The joy of rowing is to row. The joy of practice is to practice. The joy of loving is to love. That experience, that activity is self-fulfilling. It's self-fulfilling. It is not a means to an end. My loving of someone is not a means to an end. It is the end. In Zen, practice is practice. We practice for the joy of practice. That's it. The joy of life is to live. There isn't anything extra. There isn't anything to achieve or attain. The joy of anything, actually, is the thing. Really, isn't it? This changes our relationship with experience, doesn't it? If I start thinking maybe everything is Dharma, everything's wanting to show up to help me, to support me, everything is showing up as the river, and I'm being carried along by this wonderful thing I'm beginning to trust. What is the Dharma of sweeping the floor? Is it because this is an activity that's a drag, but I really need to have a clean floor at the end of it? Or is the Dharma of that my arms are moving, I can feel the weight of the broom in my hands, I hear the sound of the shh, shh, right? Is this moment complete, or is this moment lacking something, and it will be complete when clean floor arrives? Is the joy of shower to just be in shower, or is the joy of shower, how quickly can I do this so that I can become clean because this activity is a means to a later end? We see this in ourselves all the time. It's so much the way our minds work. My Zen practice is this thing that I do so that I get to this thing called, I don't know what, more happy or calmer or more chill or da-da-da-da-da. Sure, you bet. That's true. And it's simultaneously true that the joy of practice is to practice. And the less I'm trying to wring out of this moment for me, the more I get. There's the great paradox, I suppose. Merrily, 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 merrily is about joy. It's just, like I said, it's just love. It's just love. The people in your life that you love deeply are people that you love because you love them. And you don't love them because of what they do for you, and you don't love them because of how they make you feel, or because they are smart, or they are good, or they're convenient, or their breath smells like mint. We have people in our lives like that, certainly, but that's not real love. We love people because they are. Because they are. So when they show up broken, we love them. And when they show up whole, we love them. And when they show up happy, we love them. And when they show up sad, we love them. They just are, and our response is to love them. It's non-contingent. It's self-fulfilling. I'm not loving you as a means to an end. I'm loving you because you're here. Merrily, merrily, merrily. And the last thing I'll say about this line is that when Dogen calls this type of activity self-fulfilling activity, activity done for its own sake, not as a means to a selfish end or a limited end, he's taking away the limits of the activity. Does that make sense? Instead of, I'm sweeping to get clean floor, that's putting a limit on sweeping, right? It's actually got a pretty small agenda now. Clean floor is the agenda. That's very limited. When he says it's self-fulfilling, it's not limited by your idea about what its goal is. That activity is by definition unlimited. He's pointing to the nature of reality showing up as undividedness, right? The experience of my life and my ideas about my experience, are they separate? Do my ideas limit my experience of the world? Love, joy, suffering, death. Can you really separate any of those things? I can't. I can't separate any of them. No limits. No limits. So we say merrily, essentially because our practice is good. It's good. Isn't it good to be here? It's good to be here. Sit quiet on black cushion. I've decided that's good. I don't think there's anything more to it than that. Sit quiet on black cushion. Helps. Seems to be helpful in this world. It's good. It's good in the beginning. It's good in the middle. It's good in the end. All right. Merrily, 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 merrily. Life is but a dream. Is our last sentence. Life is but a dream. Oh, dear. Well, there's a lot you could say about this line in a Buddhist context. You could easily give an entire talk on it. You could probably easily have an entire practice period on it. So I'm only going to skate along the surface here a little bit. Life is but a dream. So the Diamond Sutra, a famous Mahayana, one of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, says all conditioned phenomena are like a dream, an illusion, a bubble, a shadow, like dew or a flash of lightning. Thus we shall perceive them. All conditioned phenomena are like a dream. So that's pretty much right out of the Buddhist scripture. Life is but a dream. Conditioned phenomena. Dharmas. Moments of experience is what we're talking about. Being like a dream. For those of you who are familiar with Norm Fisher, he wrote a wonderful book a couple years ago on the Tibetan Lojong sayings, which I only know this much about, very, very little about. But there's 49 training sayings in the Tibetan Lojong school, and the third one of them is regard all things as a dream, regard all dharmas as a dream. And the idea with these sayings is let them roll around in you, kind of, and just sit with them for a long, long time, kind of the way we do with koans in Zen, some of us. When I first read this, I was really, really puzzled by it. Like, I'm pretty sure this isn't a dream. That hurts when I hit my head. I'm awake. I know what dreaming is, and then the alarm goes off and I'm not dreaming. Hello! You guys are weird. I don't get your deal. All conditioned phenomena are like a dream. So where I went with this is, I think the one-word version, I sometimes, if I'm having a hard time understanding a passage, especially scriptural, but Dharma teaching, I think if I were to try to distill this down to a simpler sentence or even to one word, what would it be? It kind of helps me get a grab on it. I think the one word version of this, life is but a dream, is play. In fact, then I started thinking, I think the one word version of the entire poem, the entire song, is play. 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 Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 merrily. Life is but a dream. Play. That sounds like play to me. This Zen thing is funny. It's just really funny. This life actually is funny. I can't separate those two things either. We're trying to get to this place that we're already at. Yeah. Using a path that doesn't exist. That's play to me. I mean, come on, man. Right? Isn't it play? Of course it's play. It's very, very serious play. You know, if you've ever seen a kid play, it's serious business out there in the sandbox. You've noticed that, right? Like, this is, you know, it's self-fulfilling activity. There's no logical end to play except for when the bell rings and mom says, you're done. It isn't done for the sake of anything else. I'm developing really useful interpersonal skills right now that later, it's like, nope. They're just playing for the sake of playing, and they're super into it. It's the most serious thing in the world. And yet, it's play, and they're making it up as they go. It sounds a lot like what we do here, you guys. I mean, this is our sandbox, essentially. Aren't we all in the same big sandbox? So in Zen, we play. We do, we play. It's what we were just doing for 40 minutes here. We play in awareness itself. We play in awareness itself. Romp and play in samadhi. Samadhi is absorption, concentration. Singing and dancing are the voice of the Dharma, Hakuin says. Singing and dancing, the voice of the Dharma. A Native American elder, he's a spiritual elder in his tribe, was quoted recently that I read this, and I pulled this out from my talk. He said, "We do not believe our religion, we dance it." We do not believe our religion, we dance it. And I went, oh, that's Zen. We dance, like, stationarily. But it counts. Doesn't that count? That totally counts. Do you believe Zen? No. You sit it. You practice it, right? You practice it. It's you showing up on the cushion that creates Zazen. That's what creates Zen. There's no Zen apart from that. How could there be? Right? Aren't you dancing your faith? Of course you are. Then even the word faith is extra. Then even the word belief is extra. What is there to believe? Just sit. Just sit. That's when Zazen becomes more than meditation technique. I'm kind of with Dogen. I mean, we talk about it being meditation is useful, but I'm kind of with Dogen when he says, Zazen is not meditation. He's really adamant about that in the Fukan Zazengi. Zazen is not meditation. It's a lot more dance, I think, than it is meditation. I also think it's a lot more play than it is work. I'm not saying it's not hard. I know we normally equate work with hard and play with fun, and I'm pointing to something bigger than this. Play is a lot of times not fun, and work is a lot of times really fun. I'm taking away that. I'm saying Zazen is a lot more like play than it is like work. At least for us who are grown-ups, because usually work means to end, the thing I do to punch in and out to get currency, da-da-da-da-da, and play is what I do on the weekend when I'm off the clock. Well, when you're on the cushion, you are off the clock. You are off the clock. Somebody else is in charge of the clock. She is. Right over there. Darla is not off the clock so that we can all be off the clock. You're off the clock. You get to play for 40 minutes in awareness itself. And that's important. That's really important. Awareness itself is where we find our experience of wanting nothing, right? Awareness itself wants nothing. It doesn't want anything. Awareness doesn't need anything. When we're awake, we instinctively don't hurt anything. Awareness itself. I'm awake enough to know that there's not separation. If I'm wide awake, I can't hurt you. If I'm wide awake, I can't hurt anything. Awareness itself is where we play. If you could see a single flower clearly, your whole life would change. I saw that recently online attributed to the Buddha. It doesn't to me sound like something he would have said, but all sorts of stuff is attributed to the Buddha. Why not? When you see stuff attributed to the Buddha that you like, go with it. If you see stuff attributed to him you don't like, pitch it. If you could see a single flower clearly, your whole life would change. So awareness itself is dynamic, and it's alive, and it's vibrant, and it's shimmering, and it's awake. Our rowing, our effort, our merrily is awakeness. And that's what I'm putting under the category of dream. Life is but a dream. Our fundamental experience of life is ungraspable. You can tell me all about the things you did yesterday, but you can't smell those smells. You can't hear those sounds. It's a dream. It doesn't mean it's not real. It means it's a dream. It's not as solid as you believe it is. It's not as real as you believe it is. It's not as important as we normally think it is. It's much bigger than that. It's much more spacious than that. And we say this over and over in Zen about the nature of mind. Dynamic, vibrant, shimmering, luminous, and yet totally still. Right? That movement is still somehow. It's silent, we say silent, but we're not talking about the absence of sound. We're talking about the absence of self. Silence is the absence of self in Zen. It's not the absence of sound. That's the kind of stillness we're talking about. The way, the practice, is just a quality of heart that wants nothing. It doesn't want anything. It doesn't need anything. Awareness doesn't want anything. It doesn't need anything. It's awareness. It's what you are. So our commitment doesn't come from the outside. Our commitment arises from the inside. I think our commitment in Zen is to deep contentment. And that contentment is not limited to us. When I vow to be content, I vow to get rid of the things that cause discontent in self or other. I'm committed to your contentment as well as my own. And contentment also does not come from the outside. True contentment comes from the nature of our hearts and minds when we want nothing to be different. It is non-contingent peace. It is not reliant on everything lining up so that I feel comfortable. It's a state of me not needing anything to be different than it is. That's all contentment really is. Not wanting things to be different. So this type of play wants nothing but itself. It is not a means to an end. And although in traditional Buddhism the idea is to awaken from the dream, awaken from the dream, awaken from the dream, in Zen, as Tim has said, we awaken to the dream. We awaken within the dream. There's no reason to kill that dream. There's no reason to vanquish it. Don't worry about it. It's going to leave and come. It's part of the deal. Awaken within it. Awaken to it. So, to wrap up here, to finish. When you engage with the circumstances of your life as play, when you engage with the circumstances of your life as dharma, when you engage with the circumstances of your life as practice, as opportunity, you're letting your life work on you. You're letting your life soften you. You're letting your life knead you. K-N-E-A-D. You're letting your life mold and strengthen you into something bigger than you would have had an idea about. Something happens to your heart when you see your life that way. This is play. This is dharma. This is practice. This is what this is right now. Something happens. Something absolutely happens to your quality of experience. And that's our invitation. That's the invitation of Zen practice. And I know that this thing happens. It does. It does. Try. Try it and see. Try it and see. Thank you. Thank you very much. We still have about 5 minutes or so. So if you guys have thoughts, comments, questions, other poems or childhood songs.
Ted. Yes. This poem is often sung as a round. Is there a teaching in that?
Yes. There is. Oh, you want the teaching?
Yeah.
Oh! Oh, 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 oh. Yeah, you know, actually, when I was playing around with this idea, when I first started working on this a couple months ago, I thought, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to have this side of the Zendo and the Founders Hall, and then this side of the Zendo, and then we can all just sing the round. I thought, well, that's going to go off the rails for sure. But my thought about it, Ted, that's a great question, actually, was that when you're singing around, you know, you realize you're at a different place in the song than somebody else. Mm-hmm. You're doing a totally different thing, actually. Mm-hmm. And yet there's, like, this perfect synchronizing harmony that arises. They're just doing their own practice, rowing their own boat. You're rowing your own boat, doing your own practice, and yet together there's this fabulous thing occurring, which couldn't have happened alone. It's more than one voice.
Right.
I think it's just Sangha. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you got something else?
There's that. Something about no limits, too. It seems endless when you're doing that. And if it's endless, well, we're not doing it to accomplish something.
Yeah.
We're not trying to get to the end of the song and say, who did that? You know, it's just, so here we are.
Yeah.
Singing this particular love.
You should give a row, row, row your boat to him. There's a lot here. This, I would like, well, like, whoever wrote this, this is genius stuff. Yeah. Forget Dogen. I'm going into Mother Goose. It's going to be nothing but the old stuff. Thank you. Benton.
Well, boat could also refer to the Mahayana great vehicle.
Ah, yes. I love it. Yes, or the boat, when Tim talked a couple weeks ago about the boat being constructed of the paramitas, the perfections of that. Oh, that could be the boat. You can totally make this up, you guys. It can just be your little fishing skiff on Mille Lacs with your little 15-horse Evinrude, or it can be your Carnival Cruise Line. It's all good. I like that. What else today? Anything? All right, well, I'm very... Oh, please, Diana.
I just want to say this is exactly what I needed to hear this morning. Yeah. I really appreciate it. I'm working really hard on slowing down my life, and that's not an easy thing, and this is just taking this very simple song that we all know from our childhood and bringing it down and thinking about how that is, and play, because that is, I need to learn how to play, just being here right now with happiness.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. It feels like going against the stream almost to, like, try to slow down, doesn't it? Doesn't it? It really does. It almost seems like countercultural. Like, I'm going to try to do less. It's almost like, God, you can almost get arrested for that. I think it's un-American. I'm with you. It's not easy, is it? Good for you. Good for you. Did you have your...
Oh, what if the little storm comes up? A little rain.
Oh. Have you experienced breezes?
It's just a lot. It seems like there's some breezes out there, you know, when I step
yes,
up by the door.
Ah.
You know, it's like a lot merrily, but there's some...
Not so merrily?
Not merrily sometimes.
Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Isn't that true? Yeah, you're right, of course. I think part of the reason the word merrily worked for me is because I did equate it with joy. And we talked a little bit about this we had a mindfulness class here a number of time ago, and we talked about how our experience oftentimes arises as more layered than we expect. Like, how are you feeling? Sad. Well, what else? There's something else going on. There's usually a chord, like experience. We talked about how emotions come in chords. I feel really happy and really hopeful and 5% anxious. I feel really sad and really despairing and 3% hungry or whatever. Like, your experience is really, really detailed. And I find that oftentimes for me, under the umbrella of joy is difficulty. Real, honest to God, sometimes heart-wrenching, potentially life-threatening difficulty. And I don't know how it would be for you. I think I tend to relate to practice, like the formal practice, in those times more as like refuge. Mm-hmm. Like my whole life is kind of a Jackson Pollock painting right now. It's just a disaster, an artful disaster. But, you know, for 40 minutes on the cushion, I can set a timer, and I can either be present to that disaster and really let it get close to me. But there's a dimension for me, at least, of refuge, I guess, is the only word I can really think of. Because, yeah, you're right. The poem is really about practice. It isn't really about our experience. And obviously, you know, our experience of life can be very, very tumultuous, very, very, very difficult. And at the same time, we can still have this sense, I know the direction in which I am moving. I'm continuing to row. And merrily, maybe you're showing up as, oof, really, really difficult. You know, I'm not sure that's answering your question, but you're raising a really interesting, point. You know? Well, thank you. Okay, well, thank you all for being here. I'll turn this over. Oh, Crystal, please. You have time.
You guys ever noticed that there's a very small canoe on a Minnesota license plate?
Yeah.
So there's a reminder to play.
Is it really? Thank you. There it is. Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, as endorsed by the state of Minnesota. Tim had to lobby long and hard. Thank you, Crystal. I love that. All right. Thank you all. I'll turn this over to Darla.